And that's a good thing. So without any further ado, and it is my honor and privilege to introduce to you Bob Darrell from Las Vegas, Nevada.
My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And through God's grace, good sponsorship, commitments, a good home group, and bushels of newcomers, I've been sober since Halloween 1978. And that, to this day, blows my mind. I'm really glad to be here. I really want to thank Jim for picking me up at the airport and driving me up here from Tallahassee through Havana. What is it?
Havana.
Havana. Yeah, we're there. And I want to thank Diz and Sissy for inviting me down here and the hospitality and the great basket in the room. And there's some people here I've known for a few years, and it's good to see them again. And I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. Want to welcome anybody that's new. If you're in your first several months of sobriety, I'm real glad you're here. If you're in your last several months of sobriety and you don't know it, I'm glad you're here. And I hope that either way you will hear something or see something that we will connect with this weekend that will cause a fire inside you for and a hunger for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one who, I don't know for sure that I was born with alcoholism, but I'll tell you, I was a little peculiar before I ever drank. There was something that wasn't quite right about me. I was, I look back over my childhood, the only thing I can really remember is me. I remember all about me. I can't tell you too much about my mom and dad or my sister unless that had to do with me. I was that internally focused and self-involved, even as a little kid. My mother used to tell me, Rob, you're full of yourself, and I never knew what she meant until I got into AA, and then I started putting the pieces together. Oh, yeah, I know. Now I know what she's talking about. I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I came from a home where there was a lot of love. I was never mistreated. My parents were always on my side, went out of their way to do anything they could to add something to my life. Tremendous amount of love in our household, but there was something about me even as a little kid that I couldn't feel it. My sister could feel it, but I was that self-involved even as a little kid. I couldn't feel the love. And I had spent, that's a condition I've known most of my life. I'm like the black hole of love. I mean, you can't love me enough, right? It just doesn't do nothing to me because I'm just that way. And I one Sunday afternoon, my folks and I, we'd gone out to an outing. And we used to do a lot of things, like we'd go to historical monuments and circuses and amusement parks and we did a lot of things together as a little kid, and I'm about 3, maybe 4 years old, and we're coming back from this outing, and my dad wants to stop at this farmer's market right outside of town where the farmers bring their wares. And my dad wants to go in there to get this horseradish that he's heard about that's won these awards or something, and it was hotter and spicier than any horseradish, you know, it's supposed to be real special. And my dad loves stuff like that. Like he was, I think it was like his alcohol. I remember watching him as a little kid with a bowl of jalapeno peppers, and he'd just eat them until sweat would just pour off him, and his eyes would glaze over. He'd be making noise like he's having sex or something, you know, like, you know, and he just, that was like his alcohol. And we're going into this farmer's market, and he's bragging to my mom about this horseradish, and he gets it, and I'm just a little kid. I don't even know what horseradish is, but I'm hearing the commercial. So I want some. I said, Papa, can I have some? He says, Rob, you can't have it. It's only for adults, too strong, can't have any. Well, there's something about me. I may not really want something until you tell me I can't have it. To this day, it's hard for me to get by a do not touch wet paint sign without, you know, it's something in me. It's like that. And they told me I couldn't have it, and I waited until my mom and dad weren't around. I went in that refrigerator, got that jar of horseradish and a big spoon. Sat on the floor of that kitchen. This was before LSD, but I think I saw God that morning. Snot's pouring out of my nose and tears are running down my eyes. I spit horseradish all over that damn kitchen. Sick, 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 sick. Pain. Awful. That was over 40 years ago. I've not once sat with a jar of horseradish. Big spoon. Didn't need no meetings, no sponsor, no steps, no nothing. But if you're new, I hope you hear this. If that horseradish would have done for me what alcohol did for me, I'd have spent the rest of my life making myself sick with that crap every chance I could get. Because I was born with a hunger and an incompleteness a thing that the book refers to as a spiritual malady called alcoholism. And even as a young kid, before I ever drank, it just seemed like my light was dim. It seemed like I couldn't connect with people the way I would observe that they so easily connected with each other. I couldn't seem to click with life the way other people seem to click with life. And it seemed like the problem with me, you know, Dr. Silkworth says something that's always been true for me, drunk or sober. He says, to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And what happens is I just adjust. I'm different, and I don't know I'm different, and I'm weird, and I ain't right, and I don't know it, and I just adjust to it. And when I was 12 years old, the disease, what I've come to understand is the spiritual illness of alcoholism, was touched for the first time by alcohol. And it was an event that changed the course of my life. I was 12 years old, and I was hanging around with a bunch of older kids in my neighborhood. They were like the juvenile delinquents of the town I lived in. And I wanted to fit with these kids so desperately because, you know, they're just cool. I mean, nothing bothers them. They know they're not afraid of nothing. They're just incredible. And on the outside, I'm trying to act like them, but secretly inside, I'm weak and pathetic. You know, and I'm full of fear, and I ain't really a tough little kid, but I'm trying to pretend like I am because I want to fit with these guys. And we pulled a burglary one day, and one of the things we stole was some bottles of whiskey. And I remember these guys passing around this quart bottle of Seagram 7. I can still remember the thing on the crown and everything on the label. And I'm observant, and I watched, and what I noticed is that as they passed it around, the bigger hit you took off the bottle, the more attention and approval you got from the other guys. Now, I don't know anything about alcohol. I never saw my parents drink. I think I might have seen them have a beer or two, and that was about it. I never seen anybody drunk. I didn't even know that alcohol got you high. I just knew it was something adults drank. And they pass this around, and it gets to me, and I'm determined to take a bigger hit than any of these other kids, because I'm always coming from behind. And I take this huge hit off this bottle of Seagram 7, almost threw it up. I don't know how I kept it down. But when the burning stopped, I'll tell you something, it made me feel so good that the way I was without it from that moment on was never enough again. And when you're 12, 13, 14 years old, you can't drink every day. But I drank every chance I could get. And alcohol did something for me in those early days for the first many years, it was just awesome. It connected me. It let me click with life. And not only did it let me come out and play and be a part of, and I could talk to people, but it put me in this zone where I couldn't miss. I remember it just vitalized my spirit. It turned my light on for the first time in my life, and I could shoot pool better than I could shoot pool. I could dance, and I don't even know how to dance. I could be funny, and normally I'm just a bump on the log. I'm the guy that don't fit well, but man, alcohol just connected me, and things would click, and it was like being in the zone, man, and it was awesome. And I just loved it. I remember some of those experiences in early drinking when it was just tremendous. And I'll tell you something, I believe with everything in me, I think that alcohol for a number of years was a dynamic and immediate and effective treatment for the real sickness of alcoholism. Because I could be going through life just locked up with my feelings and my life just on me, and I'm just dying in here, and have five or six drinks, and I could come out and play. I could talk to people. I had a sense of vitality inside, like I was alive. It was awesome. And what happened is, the big book says it's a progressive disease. I think for me it was really a disease of diminishing returns. As the years went on, my ability to obtain that kind of ease and comfort and fun and effect got less and less, and the problems got more and more and more. And my drinking became more frantic and desperate, trying to recapture the old days, and my life was deteriorating, and I didn't know what was happening to me. And I didn't know why I kept getting in so much trouble. But I'm the guy that Dr. Silkworth talks about in The Doctor's Opinion. And if you're new here, I really encourage you to read that doctor's opinion and try to find yourself in that part of the book. In the doctor's opinion was where I claimed my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because once I could see myself in that part of the book, I knew that I was under a death sentence. I knew I got it. I connected the dots. I knew I had a terminal illness. Not maybe, and this wasn't, and people weren't saying that to be dramatic, that it was true. That I have a terminal illness called alcoholism. And I'm the guy he talks about. He says, guys like me, when we drink, we have an allergic reaction to alcohol, unlike normal drinkers. When I drink, I don't break out in hives or a rash. I break out in what Silkworth calls a phenomenon of craving. I remember sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as a newcomer, and, you know, in the first year or so, and I would listen to people describe their drinking. And I would listen to people talk about what would happen to them when they drink and what alcohol did for them. And you hear the same things, I'm sure, and I heard in Las Vegas as you would hear down here, that people would talk about how they would drink and they could come out and play, or they would drink and become fearless, or they would drink and feel like they're bulletproof, or all the things. And I would think, as I would hear all that stuff, I would think, yeah, that's all true most of the time. But there was one thing that was true every drink I ever took, from the first one to the last one, is that every drink of alcohol I ever took made me feel like I'd like to have another drink of alcohol. And that was always true for me. I have never once in my life had the experience that social drinkers have, where they're drinking in a bar for an hour or so and have the bartender come over and say, hey, Bob, would you like another drink? I've never once inside myself thought, no, this is just right. Not once. I never got just right. But you know what happened to me? I'd get close. I'd get so close it would make me crazy. I would get a feeling like I'm about to be there, maybe on the next drink. And I drank with a sense of urgency. I was one of those guys that just would hammer them down with this frantic feeling like I'm about to become wonderful, just maybe on the next drink. And I get so close it'd make me nuts. If you're new here, there's a test in the big book. It says if you're not sure if you're an alcoholic, you take this test. And I don't recommend the test personally. I'm too afraid to recommend it, honestly, because I'd be afraid to recommend it and you'd try it and get in your car and kill some people or yourself, and then I'd sit in a meeting and feel bad when I heard about it. So I don't really recommend the test. But the test is, if you're not sure you're an alcoholic, try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. And it says try it more than once. You might find out whether you're an alcoholic or not. But, you know, I don't think it's a viable test, really, for a guy like me. Because when you think about it, okay, I'm going to go down here to this bar, and I'm going to take the test. I'm going to have two drinks. And that's it. Go home, don't smoke nothing, take nothing, two drinks, that's it. Well, about halfway through the second drink, it's going to become very apparent to me that this is not a good test day. It's a good test, but Joe's over here, and I've got to have a drink with Joe, and then there's some girl over here, I've got to have a drink with her. And tomorrow would be a much better test day. And, you know, tomorrow would come, and my bad luck again. It'd be another bad test day for a guy like me. Because once I have a couple drinks, it's like a key turns in my head, and all of my ability to rationalize and justify and everything in me just gets right behind whatever's necessary to satisfy a craving. And that's why all my drinking, I thought it was always my idea. And I couldn't see the phenomenon of craving until I listened to a woman share about her experience, an experience she had where she had a few drinks and couldn't get any more. And I remembered an incident that happened to me where I was at a dinner party and I had a couple drinks and I couldn't get any more, and all of a sudden I could see it. Because the problem with a craving is you don't realize you have it unless it's interrupted. Everybody in this room tonight's in the grip of a craving you're not aware of because you're satisfying it. That's a craving to breathe air. But if someone were to sneak up behind you with a plastic bag and put it over your head, you'd realize instantly you got this craving to breathe air. And that was why it was so hard for me to see the phenomenon of craving, because I just avoided situations where I could only get two or three and then could not get any more. And I had to see that I had that thing that Silkworth talks about. But he talks about something else, and I think it's really what almost killed me. And it was so... so hard for me to connect the dots. He says that guys like me, when I stop drinking, I become restless, irritable, and discontented, unless I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort I'd once found in taking a few drinks. And for all practical purposes, my alcoholism starts where the bottle ends. And I enter into a state of abstinence and I'm restless. And what it is that I just can't get a sense of being settled anywhere. I'm like one of those dogs that circles a room looking for its spot to lay down. I'm a dog who can't find its spot. Wherever I am, I just, after being there a very short while, I just know that this ain't it. Now, I don't know where it is, but it ain't here. And I'm irritable, and I get on the muscle with people, and I don't mean to be that way. I don't mean to be defensive and aggressive, or to get so irritated by people in life and threatened by them that I withdraw so deeply into myself that some psychiatrist is diagnosing me as clinically depressed. And I'm not really clinically depressed, I'm spiritually depressed. I get the depression of the intensely overly self-involved. I'm just, you know, in here. There's one of the best descriptions of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever seen anywhere. It was actually used in a radio address by a doctor who was an alcoholic, and he came to a few AA meetings just to observe us. And here's what he said. It's reprinted in the back of the big book. This guy, Bill Baer, he was addressing in a radio broadcast, the AMA, and he said, here's what he said about us just after going to a few meetings. He said, these Alcoholics Anonymous people, they're not crusaders. They're not a temperance movement. What they are is people who realize that they cannot drink. So they devote their lives to helping other people with similar problems. And then this is the part that got me. He says, and in this atmosphere of helping others with similar problems, the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive over-concentration upon himself. And I thought, Bill, is it that obvious? I mean, I was 5 years sober before I started to get that. And he just came to a few meetings and he could watch us and realize that we had this excessive over-concentration upon ourselves. And I'm discontented. I don't know what it is. All my life has been something wrong with me and I didn't understand what it was. But no matter what great things would come into my life or I could achieve or do, the shine of them would wear off so very quickly for me. And I could never seem to change that. And it seemed like I lived in a world where people got stuff and just appreciated it and were grateful for it forever. And then there was me and I could get something and just after a very short period of time, that ain't it. And I get something else and that ain't it. And I was just chronically malcontent. And I just seemed, and I'll tell you, Silkworth, he says a funny thing. He says that we are like that. We're restless, irritable, and discontent. He doesn't say unless we drink again. He says unless we can recapture that sense of ease and comfort we'd once found. And you know what I think would happen to me, and I never realized it until I was sober a long time and I was listening to a fifth step, is that I could be dry for a period of time and I would really be frantically trying to make myself better and I would get a great job. And it would be the best job I ever had. The job I always wanted. And after a while at that job, I think subconsciously I'd start to compare what it felt like to have that job to what it felt like to have 5 shots of tequila, and I don't want the job no more. And I did that with relationships and automobiles. I did it with a lot of stuff, comparing how this thing against the what alcohol had once done for me. I'm the guy who knows he can't drink and drinks anyway. In 1971, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in an institution. I wasn't even old enough to take a legal drink quite yet. And I was sent to this AA meeting, and I remember sitting there and I didn't want to be there. I'm a young kid. I mean, you people were, God, you were 35, 40 years old. Your life was over. I mean, I was under the illusion that the good days were about to come, that I had some bad luck. But it was really about to get wonderful. And little did I know that I was on the road into hell. Didn't even know it. I remember sitting in those meetings and I, it's not that I wasn't in trouble and it wasn't, not that I didn't understand that I really shouldn't drink. It's just that I can't understand what you're talking about. And I can't connect with you because I'm the kind of guy, when I stop drinking, I have certain defense mechanisms that come into play that I don't even know I have. You see, I don't know that when I'm sober, I'm afraid of you. And I don't feel, and secretly, I don't feel like I measure up. And to compensate for that, I have these defense mechanisms of judgment. And so I sit in the meetings and I just pick apart everything I hear and see in AA. And it's like that old dumbwaiter effect. If I could pull you down, maybe I'll come up. Right? And guys like me that are secretly inadequate and full of fear, we do these pathetic things to try to balance things out by pulling everybody else down, and it never really worked. It just made me separate, and it put me in a position within inside myself where it was impossible to hear your message. I can't connect with people I'm defending myself against. And so I've sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I never heard the message. And I didn't, you people were, made me very uncomfortable. I'm the kind of guy that when I'm not drinking, I don't like happy, enthusiastic people. I don't like you. I don't know what you are. You're like a weird cross between Amway and the Salvation Army or some crap. I mean, you just make me crazy. And you're all glad to see me. And I ain't glad to see anybody. I don't even want to be here. I remember sitting in the meetings, and it became so apparent to me that whatever's wrong with me is not the same thing that's wrong with you. Because I've quit drinking, and abstinence feels like I'm doing time. And you quit drinking, and look at you. You're wonderful. You're magnificent. I hate you, but you're everything that I secretly would like to be. And you seem to have gotten that just from quitting drinking. And I'm quitting drinking and I'm doing time here. And I don't know, so I come to the conclusion that yes, I have some serious problems. But they're not the same as yours. It's something else. And I spent a lot of years in therapy, and I went to some of the best psychiatrists in the world. My father was in government and he had a lot of juice, and they got me in to see a guy named Albert Ellis, and I was in therapy with him for a while. He was the founder of a whole branch of psychotherapy called rational emotive therapy. I went to see a Gestalt therapist for a couple years. It was a contemporary of Fritz Perls, and I really wanted to find out what's wrong with me. Because, you know what it seemed like to me? It seemed like even though I came from a good family, I just had a sense that they must have somehow damaged me. Because I felt damaged. You know, and they must have, maybe I was mis-potty trained or something, you know, as a kid, something. And I thought in therapy, I'll find out what it is, and then when I uncover it, I'll deal with it, and like a child's helium balloon that is released, I will soar into mental health. And all of a sudden, I'll take my place and be like you and feel like you and act like you and it'll be good. And I could never find out what it was. And I even got referred to a hypnotherapist, and I got regressed back in my childhood because I thought, you know, I must be blocking it out. This thing that happened to me, I never found out what it was because it was a spiritual illness. I think I was born with it, this hole in my soul, this yearning. In A Vision for You, Bill calls it an insistent yearning. And all my life I've had that. I had it before I ever had alcohol. I couldn't have told you what it was a yearning for, but I always had it. This tremendous sense that there's something deep inside of me that's missing. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know that it was a spiritual illness, but I knew it was there. It just drove me. I thought that if I could, it was a futile effort. Not that I didn't do some good work in therapy. It just was not the problem. I started getting more and more desperate as my alcoholism progressed, and there was even a time in the mid-70s when I got a sponsor, and it's hard for a guy like me to ask for help. You know, I'm that egomaniac with the inferiority complex. I would rather die than look like I need help. You know what I mean? I'm that kind of guy, and that's not good news if you identify with that. And I finally reached out and I got this sponsor and I started talking to him, and I'm
doing what he tells me to do. And I look back, and this guy wasn't even an alcoholic. There are people in Alcoholics Anonymous that aren't alcoholics of my type. It talks about them on page 20 and 21 of the big book. They look like alcoholics. The book says that they drink habitually, says that they have the habit badly enough that it gradually impairs them mentally and physically, but then it's, and they might die a few years before they should, but if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, warning from a doctor, etc., that those people can just stop on their own. They may need some medical help or whatever, but they have what it takes to put the bottle down and kind of be restored to normal living. And this guy was like that. And he had a three-step program of recovery that I tried to emulate. Step one, don't drink. Step two, go to AA to fill the social void that's now vacant from, because you're not going to bars. Like, AA to him was like the sober Elks. You know what I mean? And step three was sell Amway. And I'm doing his deal, and I'm sitting in abstinence, and I'm dying here. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And it's working, and I keep looking at him, and he's one of the happiest guys I know. He's one of the most successful guys I know. So I came to the conclusion that this won't work for me. Not too long after that, I went on a drunk. I was in a halfway house, and I was sober about as long as I could stand it. And I tell you, I'm one of those guys that no matter how tremendous my resolve is to not drink, no matter what's at stake, no matter how much I've made up my mind, I'm never going to touch that crap again. The emotions of untreated alcoholism just gradually grind away my resolve. And I can say no for a while. No, no. No, and I'm not smoking nothing. No, I ain't don't want none. No, 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 no. I said no, no, no. Okay. And for an alcoholic of my type, there's a yes in every barrel of no's. Sometimes it's at the bottom, sometimes in the middle, sometimes at the top. But left with this spiritual malady, the yes is coming. And it's like an itch I've got to scratch. I have a disease that I'll tell you, it demands treatment. It demands it. And what would happen to me is I would go into a state of abstinence and I'd eventually drink again. And I'm in this halfway house and I'm sober several months, probably 2 months longer than I wanted to be. And I just can't take it anymore. And I'm just so depressed and lonely and bored. And I got my life on me and I can't get out. And it's awful. I call up this guy that I was in detox with, and I suspected that he was back to drinking, and he was. And he lived in a little trailer in a neighboring town in Pennsylvania, and he starts telling me about this rock and roll bar that he found with these great bands and these wonderful women that are there, and he says, I got some Thai stick, and you ought to come down and hang out for the weekend, you can stay on my couch. And I'm listening to him, and I'm drooling, man, I'm just like, phew. I can't wait. And I get a weekend pass out of that halfway house. Got a weekend pass and a plan. Plans are good. The plan is I'm going to go down there. I'm going to drink all Friday night, all day Saturday, Saturday night, Sunday morning. I'm going to stop, sober up so I can get back to the halfway house so I don't lose my place to live, so I'm not out in the streets. Good plan. Because I'm still a victim of the illusion that I can control and enjoy my drinking, right? Now, I'm not... The illusion is that I can get back to the fun days and that I can control it. And I never was so deluded to think that when I went on a run, I could control it to the point where there's not going to be some price to pay. My illusion is that I have the control to keep the price down to something I can live with. That's my delusion, right? And I remember a fleeting thought as I'm on the bus going to meet this guy. It's like, well, what's the worst that could happen here? They could find out that I was drinking. I lose my spot in the halfway house. That's not the end of the world. I'll go down to the Salvation Army, the mission. Maybe I can stay on this guy's couch. It'll work out. It's not the end of the world. It'd be reasonable limits of damage, you know, for the fun I'm going to have this weekend. And I remember going down there, and I got to tell you something. The best part of the whole run was the hour or two before it started. And I'll tell you something even more pathetic. The best part of every run I went on, probably the last 2 or 3 years, was the hour or two before it started. And I'm with this guy, and we're in this bar, and at that time I'm drinking 100 proof Southern Comfort double shots and beers, and I'm throwing them down, and I'm throwing them down with this tremendous anticipation, because I'm waiting for it to jump start. I'm waiting for it to kick in so I can come out and play, so I can go talk to these girls, so I can shoot some pool, so I can dance, so I can be external, and it's not kicking in. And the phenomenon of cravings on me, and I'm frantically throwing down these drinks trying to jumpstart the party, and I can't get it jumpstarted, and I'm sinking into oblivion, and I can't drink enough, and it's coming at me. And I sat there, and I remember sitting there with this awful, sick feeling, looking at everybody in the bar that was having fun, and laughing, and shooting pool, and all this stuff, and I remember sitting there thinking, what's wrong with me? And I really, for the first time, I got it that the party was over. I can drink this stuff to oblivion, but what I cannot do is I cannot get back to those good old days where it was really an effective treatment for my sickness of spirit. And I sat there and I was just as depressed and full of self-pity, drinking as I was when I was in the halfway house, and I felt like my life was closing in on me. And I found a guy there that had some amphetamines, because when you only got a weekend, you don't want to miss nothing. So I got some amphetamine so I could drink more, and I ended up drinking that whole night, all the next day. Late Saturday night, we go back to this guy's trailer, and he's burnt out, and he goes into the bedroom to crash out, and I'm supposed to crash out on the couch. But I'll tell you, I'm the kind of drunk that if I'm still conscious, I ain't done drinking. But the problem is, I'm broke. I've blown all my money. But I look over, and he's got his car keys and his wallet on the kitchen counter. Now, I'm not a thief, but I do know when a loan's appropriate. And I took a little money out of that guy's wallet, and I took his car keys, and I'm going out, and I'm going to go down to this bar before it closes, just about ready to close. I'm going to go down there. I'm going to have two or three double shots and a couple beers, get a six-pack of beer to come back to the sofa in the trailer with the six-pack so I can put myself to sleep, because that's the kind of guy I am on a run. I don't go to sleep. I got to put myself to sleep. And the next thing I know, I'm coming to in a county jail, and I'm facing a couple years in a state penitentiary. I've been arrested for a hit-and-run DUI in a stolen car. They come to me, and they tell me that I can, I get a phone call. And I'll never forget this. I remember them telling me that and knowing something that made me sick inside, that there was not a person on the face of the earth that I could call. There was nobody left. I can't even put into words what a lonely feeling that is. I couldn't call my folks. They wouldn't take my calls, or they stopped helping me several years before. And I tell you something, my parents really loved me, but I just battered them emotionally. One of the worst things I kept doing is getting up again and telling them this time it's going to be different. And they would get their hopes up. And then 6 months later, I'm just trashing them one more time. And I gave them that kind of emotional battering year after year until they just couldn't take it anymore. And they just, for their own survival, had to cut me out of their life. And by this time, my mother, who's not an alcoholic, is on tranquilizers, and she's seeing a therapist, and my father sleeps 14 hours a day, because he can't live with what has happened to his son, who he loves very much. I don't have any more running partners to call. I'm the kind of guy, you drink with me once or twice, or three times maybe, and you don't want to drink with me anymore. I'm a pig. I drink frantic. We split a bottle of wine, you don't get your half. Right? I mean, I'll try to convince you you got your half, but you're telling you didn't get your half. And I don't have a girlfriend or a relationship. It's not that I didn't want one. It's just hard getting a date when you're homeless. It's like, baby, you want to come back to the halfway house and watch TV in the TV room. I mean, you can't jumpstart that easily. It's a hard deal to get going. So I'm all alone, and I have no one to call, and I eventually start calling bail bondsmen, but they want you to have like a job and an address, and I don't have any of that stuff. So I sat in that county jail for a better part of 6 months. I went before a judge who sentenced me to 2 years in a state penitentiary, and when he said that, I thought I was going to die. I don't jail well. I've been in a lot of county jails. I still got scars from beefs I've gotten into in county jails back on the East Coast. And when he said 2 years, I thought, I can't do 2 years. I just can't do it. I'll be the guy who hangs himself. I can't do 2 years. And I almost didn't hear what he said next. And he said, But he said, but we're gonna stay the commitment. And he said, well, the PO department found a place that'll take you. I'd burn out every other place. There was one place left. It was called the Ark House. It was on the north side of Pittsburgh, and it wasn't really a treatment center. It was like the bottom of the food chain for treatment. It was a place on Skid Row that just housed about 200 guys like me who were just really pathetic, and a lot of them were out of prison, or they were winos off the streets. And it was run by a guy named Chuck, who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, if you go in there, you stay a year, you get good UAs, good PO report, you make the restitution, you do everything you're supposed to do, you'll come back before us, and well, maybe you won't have to do the 2 years, but if you can't carry that out, you're going to go do the 2 years. And so I got a little relief, and I went into this place called the Ark House, and I went in there with a tremendous determination not to drink. And I can't imagine anybody, a human being, being any more determined to be sober than I was at that moment. And if determination was enough to overcome alcoholism, that would have been my sobriety date. But I'm the guy they talk about in the big book when they say, lack of power is my dilemma. I don't have the power to carry it out. No matter how much I want to, how much I make up my mind I'm never going to drink again, I can't last. And I got a short fuse. Some alcoholics have a long fuse. Some guys are just tough, and they can be dry without the steps or nothing for years. My friend Billy, one of the guys I do a lot of 12-step work with, I run around with, Billy talks about being dry for 7 years without AA, without the steps or nothing. He says it was the most miserable 7 years of his life. Not only did he lose all his friends, he lost all his acquaintances. But that's a tough bit. Billy's a tough guy. I'm not that tough. I try to act that tough. I put on the grill outfit. But the real truth inside is I got a short fuse, and I can't tough it out like that. You know, I'll tell you the guy I am. I saw this in a movie years ago. It was this movie where these Russians had captured an American spy, and they were going to torture secrets out of this guy. And they had him strapped naked to this chair, and they had this doctor, this crazy guy with these electrodes, and they were putting these electrodes on this guy's private parts, and he's screaming and withering in agony and pain. It's horrendous. And they did that to the guy hour after hour, day after day of this horrendous torture, and he finally breaks down and tells them everything they want to know. That's a tough guy. You know the guy I am? I'm the guy you just show the wires to. You know what I mean? I don't want to be that guy, but that's the truth. I'm a wimp, really. And when my emotions start putting the screws to me, I hang on as long as I can. But eventually, I just go crazy. And I'm in this place, and I'm not drinking, and I ain't drking day in and day out, and week in and week out, and month in and month out, and I'm losing it. And I don't want to drink no more, and I don't want to go to prison, and this is, the party's over, and I just don't want to do this no more, but I can't take it. And eventually I picked up a drink. It actually started with NyQuil. It's not that I had a cold, but I could feel one coming. Next thing I know, I'm not only drinking bottles of NyQuil, I'm getting thrown out of the halfway house, and now my PO's I'm going to be in trouble with the courts, and I'm going to go through 2 years, and my life's over. And I'm in this park, and I'm drinking a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose, and I can't get any relief in the bottle anymore, and I've become one of those drunks that cries, and that has, my hands are always, I'm bruised from falling down, and my hands are always messed up because I get just crazy and punch trees and stuff. I don't know why I do that. I just, like, I hate myself, I guess. And I'm always banged up, and I'm pathetic. And I don't want to do it anymore. And I amble down to this bridge in Pittsburgh, on the north side of Pittsburgh, and I walk out on this bridge at the edge of the river, and there's about a 100-foot drop down to these railroad tracks below, and I'm standing on this bridge, and I'm out there because I just want this to stop. I'm out there because I don't want to do this no more. I'm out there because I feel so hopeless. I'll tell you something, when alcohol and combinations of drugs and alcohol don't give you any relief, and that drunkenness sucks, and abstinence sucks, suicide starts looking like a good deal to a guy like me. And I'm out on that bridge because I don't want to do this no more. And I ain't out there to try to get, you know, have people, you know, have people feel sorry for me. I'm out there because I want to stop. And I'm on that bridge, and I broke down. I started sobbing because I can't do it. I don't have the courage. I'm afraid. I'm afraid it'll hurt or something. I don't know what I'm afraid of, but I can't make the jump. And it's not that I don't want to. I can't do it. And what would have been tragic is if I would have jumped, I would have never understood what was killing me. It would have never occurred to me that it was alcoholism. It would have never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol at all. I might have thought that I was dying of loneliness for some peculiar reason, because I didn't fit anywhere drunk and I don't fit anywhere sober. And if you would have asked, I would have died thinking that I tried AA and it didn't work. And you would ask me, I said, oh yeah, I was part of AA. Well, I was never part of AA. And I'd gone to hundreds of meetings. I wasn't part of AA, I was part of the passing parade that goes through Alcoholics Anonymous on its way to the graveyard. And I thought just because I sat in a few of your meetings that I'd done AA. And I looked around and I did AA the way some people do, and there's certain people that just go into one or two meetings a week and they can stay sober and they're happy like that, and I ain't that guy. And if you're new here, I really encourage you to play the hand you're dealt. I don't know what hand you're dealt, but I almost died trying to play somebody else's hand. And I'm the guy that talks about in the big book. I'm the guy that's prone to misery and depression. I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent. I'm the guy that has no effective mental defense against the first drink. I'm the guy that has to have a spiritual experience or I will die with this disease. I will die. Little did I know that was going to be my last drunk. And I started hitchhiking cross country with a guy I met that also ran away from that treatment center, that place, the Ark House, and he went back to drinking, and we started hitchhiking cross country, and I'm running from the law, and I ended up in Las Vegas. And I ended up in a detox there. I got into this detox, and I was really in bad shape physically, and I was in bad shape mentally and emotionally. And I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I'll tell you what had happened to me. And I didn't understand this until about a year or so later, and I heard a guy named Chuck C. talk, and all of a sudden I got it, what had happened to me. But I remember sitting in those early meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for the first time in 7 years, I'm sitting in AA, and I'm nodding my head. I'm sitting in AA, and you're talking about stuff, and I'm getting it. I'm sitting there, and I'm identifying with you. I thought, well, there's a special kind of AA in Las Vegas. And it wasn't that at all. What it is that the view's different from the bottom. I had just enough of me beaten out of me that I wasn't defending myself against what you were saying. I started to identify. And I heard some things, and I started to claim my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in no time at all, something happened. I started going crazy. And all of a sudden, the 2 years in prison's right here. And it's haunting me. And I grabbed an old-timer in AA, and I started telling him about it. I said, you know, I got facing this 2 years in prison, probably some tack on time. I've come all the way across country, and I don't know what to do. And he said to me, he says, well, you have to turn yourself in and offer to go back at your own expense and do the 2 years and any additional time they want to give you. And I said, what? Whoa, wait, hey, I'm sober here. This is good. He says, you have to turn yourself in. I said, no, I can't. He says, you got to. I said, I can't. I don't want to do that. He says, listen, you want to be sober or you want to die of alcoholism? Well, I want to be sober, but geez. He says, think about it. He says, how long do you think you're going to stay sober where you can't get a driver's license, you can't use a Social Security card, you can't go to work anywhere? Every time a cop car goes down the street, your gut just clenches up and you're in terror. How long are you going to stay sober like that, looking over your shoulder until the anxiety just grinds you to a point where you're going to have to drink or take something for relief from that? How long are you going to stay sober, kid? I thought, oh, crap. he's telling me the truth, but I don't want to hear it. And if you're new, stay away from those old-timers. I mean, they got like this spiritual karate thing going on, man. They just back you into a corner. So I said, what do I do? He said, look. He said, you write your P.O. a letter. In the letter, you tell him where you are. I was staying in this halfway house. You give me address and phone number there.
You tell him that you're early in sobriety and you want to do whatever it takes to get free and to get this off your back, and you're willing to come back there at your own expense and do the 2 years and anything else they want you to do. And then you tell him in the letter that you will call him, give him 10 days. You'll call him on a certain day at a certain time, and then you got to call him. And I wrote that letter and I showed it to him, and he said, good letter. And I took it down to the mailbox. I remember putting it in the mailbox, and it went down in there, and I couldn't get it back. He was like, oh, my God. I can't even describe the anxiety that I thought, oh, what have I done? This guy's never even been to prison. Why am I listening to him? This is crazy. I got to move. Where can I move to? I got to move quick. And the next 10 days were awful. I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, they're going to get me. I'm going to have to go to prison. I wonder if I'll ever like being married to Bubba. Oh, my God. You know, it was awful. The day came that I'm supposed to call this guy, and I call him up, and this woman, his secretary, answers, and she's expecting my call. And she puts me right through to him, and he's on the phone, and he says, I've been waiting for your call. I'm glad you called. He said, I talked to my supervisor, and they went to the courts, and you don't have to come back. You got to report to this place called CRS. You got to take a class down there, a couple-hour class once a week. You got to report to this other guy. He's going to be your PO. And you got to get UAs, and you got to send us money every month for the restitution. And if you do all of that, you'll be all right. But if you don't do it, you got to come back here and do the time. And I remember walking away from that phone, like I almost wanted to cry. Like it was like God, a God that I don't even really believe in, reached out to me, and it was like he was saying to me, Bob, here's a taste. It's going to be okay. Bob, I got your back. There's nothing here in AA that's going to hurt you. And it was really the beginning of my journey here. It was the first amends I ever made. I wasn't even up to step 8 yet. I wasn't even close. And I'll tell you, right after I dropped that letter in that box, in those 10 days, I'm going crazy. I went back to that guy, and I'm giving him a hard time. I said, and he says, well, Bob, in my experience, I don't think God's going to have you do the 2 years unless there's somebody in there he wants you to help. And I thought, what kind of crap is that? I don't want to help anybody in there. About six or seven years later, I was doing a meeting twice a week at this detox place, and there's a guy who comes up to me and asks me to sponsor him. I said, sure, I'll sponsor you. And he starts telling me he was on federal parole, and he from another state, and he skipped out, and he was facing 5 years. So I've been waiting for a guy like this. And I told him, I said, well, you're going to have to turn yourself in, offer to go back and do the 5 years of your own expense. He's looking at me with that look. And I gave him the whole spiel, how long you think you're going to stay. So I go, and I don't want to go back. And I did enough time. I don't want to do any more time. I said, I couldn't wait to say that. I said, well, I don't think God's going to have you do the 5 years unless there's somebody in there he wants you to help. And he looked at me with that look that I must have looked at that guy. When it comes around like that, it's better than Christmas. You know what I mean? It's a good deal. And he's looking at me like that. And Eddie did exactly what I told him to do. And he's living in this halfway house, and I get a phone call. And the federal marshals had come over there and took his ass away in handcuffs. I couldn't believe. You could hear this great oops. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what have I done? Oh, no, I shouldn't have told him that. And I'll tell you what happened. He was already in the system, and they had to violate him. But his parole officer was so impressed with what he did, he went to bat for him. And he was in the system, so the federal marshals had to come and get him. And they kept him for several weeks, and they let him go. And he's got over 17 years now of sobriety. He's a general manager of one of the larger car dealerships in Alcoholics, or in Las Vegas. There's some of those. He's got a great life, and he helps a lot of guys. I tell you, he sponsors guys down in the ghetto that nobody else can reach, and Eddie reaches those guys. He's a vital force in our community. He helps a lot of people. And every year on my A birthday, I get a letter from his mother in Memphis, Tennessee, and how she prays for me and thanks me for what I did for her son, and I never did nothing for her son. I just did what you guys did for me, that's all. Yeah. I didn't do nothing special. I started to get into the steps of AA, and I just want to talk for a minute about what had happened to me in step four. I had a couple early attempts at step four, and I didn't understand what it said in the book. So I did, you know, other ways to do it, and I guess I got something out of it. I got enough to keep me here. But what would happen to me after I did those step four and five like that is I started to suffer from alcoholism again in the rooms of AA. And it was such a subtle thing. And what started happening to me is I started noticing very clearly what was wrong with everybody in AA. You know what I mean? And I started getting more and more separate and more judgmental, and I was full of anxiety, and I was worried about a lot of stuff, and I started having battles with depression again and all that kind of crap. And I had been around AA by this time over 4 years, almost 5 years, and I finally understood what they were talking about through going to these book studies. And I went to a weekend seminar, and I understood how to do it, and I went back and I did the fourth step exactly the way it's outlined in the big book, and I'll tell you something, nothing I've ever done here has changed me more dramatically than that. Especially in the resentment section, there's a part in there that after I do the first three columns, and I've listed everyone that's ever hurt me, or annoyed me, or pissed me off, and what they did, and then what was hurt, threatened, affected, or interfered with, my pride, self-esteem, etc., etc. And then it goes on, the book goes on to say, you know, you gotta be free of this stuff. You can't wish it away any more than alcohol. If you're not free of it, it's gonna kill you. And then there's a couple little lines that changed my life. It says, this was our course. We realized that the people who had harmed us were perhaps like us, spiritually sick, even though we didn't like their symptoms and how they affected us, that they, like us, were sick too. And when I was able to go through all the people I'd ever resented, and I put myself in their shoes, and I could start to get off my high horse of judgment because I like judging people because it gives me that false sense of superiority to have those resentments and those cases built against people. And when I got off that high horse and I started to put myself in their shoes and see how if I was raised like they were raised, if I was afraid like they were afraid, if I had everything going on inside of me that was going on inside of them, that I could have easily done to somebody else what they did to me. And when I was able to see that, all of a sudden, I started taking these people off the hook. And then, for the first time in my life, I was able, because I'm not defending it anymore, I was able to see where I was at fault in those situations. I was able to ask myself those final questions. And I, for the first time in my life, I started to realize how wrong I had been in my judgments of people all my life. How wrong I'd been about my parents. How wrong I'd been about the women in my life. How wrong I'd been about the police. And how wrong I'd been about the employers and some of the running partners I had. And the exact nature of my wrongs was more than the bad things I did. I was so wrong in my judgments of others. And it extended into the fears. I believed some of my fears so adamantly I would make them come true. And at least when I made them come true, even if it meant my demise, at least I was right. You know what I mean? At least I like being right. Yeah, I'm the kind of guy, I think there's a time in my life I would rather be ruined and destroyed and be right about it than to be free and happy and have to say, well, I was wrong. I mean, that's how vested I was in being right. And what a tremendous freedom. About a dozen or so years ago, I'm sponsoring a guy, and he's doing a fifth step. And we got in about a third of the way or so into it, he gets to his father, and he starts talking about his dad, and he came from an alcoholic home. And his dad was a bad drunk. And his dad used to get drunk and just beat this kid, just unmercifully. And then sometimes when his dad was hung over, he would just be so irritable, he'd yell and scream and tell this little kid what a worthless piece of crap he was, and get out of here and shut up and you're stupid. And then sometimes he would be so remorseful coming off a drunk, he'd make these horrendous promises, you know, we're going to go to Disneyland, I'm going to get you a bike, and he'd never follow through with any of them. And this resentment towards his father owned him. And he had a tremendous case. He had a whole page on this deal. All the things his dad had done. And he'd tried to get free of it, and he spent years in therapy. He beat pillows, and he did all that stuff trying to get free of his resentment for his father. And it owned him. It affected his ability to connect and form bonds with other men. It affected his ability to work for someone. He had this authority thing. It affected his ability to have relationships with women. And we're going through it. We get to This Was Our Course, and we start talking about it. And I'm encouraging you have to see how you're like your father. And he starts screaming at me. I thought he was going to hit me. I ain't like my goddamn father. He starts cursing me and screaming at me. You know, that I would imply that he might be like his dad. My dad was a monster. He went on and on. So I just backed away. I just said, okay, let's go on to another resentment. And we get about halfway through the other resentment. And what happened next was, I think, was divine inspiration. And I think it happened because before I listened to a fifth step, I always ask God, as the guy asked the guy to bring God into the deal, and I get quiet and I ask him to make me useful. And what I said to him next was not of me. I think it was through me. As my friend Bob says, I'm never the well, but sometimes I get to be the pipe. And what had happened next was, I said, can I stop you and we can go back to something? He says, you want to go back to my dad? I said, no, I don't want to talk about your dad no more. I said, let's go back to that marriage you had in the beginning that you were talking about with the ones with the kids that were involved. He said, yeah, what of it? I said, I was just wondering if any time in that deal, if every time you were drunk or stoned on drugs or hungover or sick, if you might have ever done anything to hurt those kids. And he put his head down. And he looked up and he had tears running down his face. And he said to me this pained, choked whisper. He said, my God, just like my goddamn father. And I said, how did you feel about yourself when you hurt those kids? And he said, I couldn't stay drunk enough. I said, you think your dad's any different? And he got this funny look on his face. He says, you know, my dad's never been able to get sober. And he's old, and he's got pancreatitis and liver problems, and he cannot metabolize alcohol, and he's forced on medication. Lives in this little trailer, and nobody will talk to him. He's the most miserable, negative, lonely, fearful, neurotic person I've ever met in my whole life. I said, do you think you could be like that? And he said, yeah. Yeah, I could be like that. Could be my future without Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to watch him go back to his father and clean up his side of the street. In spite of all the out-of-line things his dad did, he started acting like a good son. And he was able to go there and be with his dad until his dad died. And he'll tell you to this day, the greatest thing Alcoholics Anonymous has given him next to his sobriety is he got his daddy back. He got his dad back. I have a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a home group. If you ever come to Las Vegas, I'm a member of the specific group, not to be confused with the Pacific group. We meet 10 times a week. 8 of those meetings are in hospitals and institutions. Our 2 main meetings is a big speaker meeting. We get about 500 people. And we have a big book step workshop on Tuesday nights, a speaker meeting on Thursday nights. And we're just a fellowship in action. And we run in a pack of guys, about 40, 50 of us. And we go from place to place doing meetings in the jails and the detoxes and the halfway houses. And it's a wonderful thing. And I have a sponsor, and I need a sponsor. I'll tell you, more important than having a sponsor, I've really thought about this a lot. I'm sponsorable. I'm sponsorable today. And I'll tell you something, that is very important to me. There have been times in my sobriety where I wasn't so sponsorable, where I wanted to run my own show and I thought that I knew what was best. And I'll tell you, doing that, I have shot myself in the foot so many times. I need a sponsor. And I'll tell you, because I got the mind of a chronic alcoholic, there's nowhere in the big book that ever assures me that I won't need AA anymore, that my thinking will once again be good enough that I can kind of run the show and I can manage my own life. There was a guy years ago, some of you might have familiar with his story, named Jim Jones. And Jim, I don't know for sure, but I suspect Jim Jones might have had what I got. Because he had some problems with drugs and alcohol, and he was a kind of a juvenile delinquent as a kid, got in some trouble, and he had a born-again experience, and he got a calling. And he decided to go into the school to become a minister, and he became a minister. And I'll tell you something, I think he was really on a great spiritual path for a long time. He went into the inner cities, he helped a lot of people. But Jim had no one to bounce. his vision of God's will off of except his own mind. If you got the mind that I got, incrementally you can get a little more bizarre and a little more bizarre and a little more. If Jim would have had a sponsor, I'm sure his sponsor would have said, Jim, the Kool-Aid is a bad idea. It's a bad deal. But he had no, I'll tell you something, I believe he committed suicide, had all those other people commit suicide, and I bet you while he was doing it, he thought he was doing God's will. And I'd like to tell you that I'm bright enough or smart enough to be immune to that kind of stuff, but I've had glimpses of myself shooting myself in the foot, sober, so many times that I've become more sponsorable than I've ever been. I was up in Northern California about a dozen or so years, maybe 15 years ago, and this guy that I'm with took me to this place where they have these big trees. And these trees are big. I mean, they're like almost, most of them are around 300 feet high. They're so big round that some of them, they have one that had a road through it. And they're just gigantic. And this guy says to me, do you notice how you don't see these trees, these huge trees, all by themselves out in the middle of a field, just stand alone? And I said, yeah, why is that? And he said, they aspire to such majestic heights that they outgrow their root systems. And the only way they can do that and survive is they have to intertwine their roots with other trees of like kind, and they form a support system that supports them all up where they can't stand alone. And I thought, isn't that what we do here? I need the guys that I sponsor to relieve me of the bondage of self, to get me off of me. I need my sponsor to direct me, to save me from my good ideas. And I need a place to come where I can feel a community. My personal recovery depends upon AA unity. I have to be a part here. And I ain't a joiner. And I'm the guy that doesn't fit when I'm sober. And it's the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've applied in my life and all the things we do here so that I can claim and maintain my seat here. Because without you, I will die. An old friend of mine, Monday morning, with almost 32 years of sobriety, put a pistol to his head sober and blew his brains out. And it's a guy that 5 years ago started getting resentments towards people in AA, and he started backing away. And then he got so depressed without us, he had to get on those happy pills. I don't know what's with those, but the people that take them don't look happy to me. I don't know what that means, and he put a pistol to his head. And I don't know, I'm not a doctor or psychiatrist, but I think he died of alcoholism. I think he died of untreated alcoholism. And I'm one who believes that if I have the same disease that he has, what could happen to him could happen to me. And so I re-up my membership to Alcoholics Anonymous. I turn the volume up on my program. Because I'll tell you something. I've been through a lot of stuff sober. I've been through 2 marriages and 2 divorces, which shows consistency. I've had both my parents die. I've had financial ups and downs. I've had all kinds of things. And I've had spots in my sobriety where even though I know from the steps that life isn't kicking me, it kind of feels like that. And I'll tell you a funny thing. When life kicks you, it always kicks you in the direction you're facing. And the people that are facing out of AA, when they get kicked, always go that way. And I got to face you and face right in here and face these steps and God's grace and my sponsor and the guys I sponsor. But if life kicks me, I want to turn up the volume on my program. Because I don't want to die of alcoholism. If you're new, I want to welcome you to AA. I'll promise you something. If you can come here and completely give yourself to this simple program, and you buy the whole package and you devote the rest of your life to helping people who suffer like you, I promise you that there will come a time that even though your life will not be perfect, that you'll look around you and your family, your AA group, your job, your neighborhood, and you won't see another person on the face of the earth that you would rather be than you. Thank you for my life.